This is Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Those places have mostly been quiet during this pandemic, with a few very high-profile exceptions.
Breaking news, a mansion party in Beverly Crest draws huge crowds and police officers. No social distancing here. So what can authorities really do about this?
The drinks were flowing. The music was blasting inside this Hollywood bar on Friday night. Our crew spotted dozens of maskless people drinking cocktails, not practicing social distancing.
Pasadena health officials say at least five people tested positive for COVID-19 after attending a birthday party there. That party was held after the safer at home order was issued and no masks were worn. NBC4's Gordon.
Well, you're probably sincerely trying to stay home as much as you can. There are some folks who are not, even though there's a pandemic. And even if the virus doesn't make them sick, they can pass it on to others. And even if those folks could wind up in the ICU. Or maybe even the cemetery. There are rules, orders, governing how to behave in public during a pandemic, as far as gatherings and social distancing and masks go. But turns out, in the wake of some large gatherings, there are still a lot of questions about what is lawful and what's not. The folks given the authority to enforce those orders are under a lot of pressure to do that, but they're also under some fire for maybe breaking those rules. Captain Stacy Spell commands the Media Relations Department over at the LAPD, and he's with us right now. Captain, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with this big party that happened on Monday at this huge house off of Mulholland Drive. There were a lot of people there, dozens if not hundreds of people. There was a shooting at this party, but before the shooting, before somebody had been killed, neighbors called the police, LAPD. Your officers showed up. The neighbors maybe felt the folks were breaking rules about gathering in large numbers during a pandemic. Officers did go check things out, but nothing happened. They didn't take any action. Why not?
Yeah. So just kind of explain a little bit about how we wind up handling parties. And even with COVID, you know, when we respond out there, if there aren't like life-threatening issues, it's not like a gang party or people running in with guns or things like that. Really, our approach is to try to obtain compliance. And in this instance, you know, our officers, they responded to the party at about 7 p.m. for the first time. And when they got out there, you know, there was a large group of people. There were some traffic issues. And so they did some enforcement. Actually, there were some impounds and they addressed, you know, getting the vehicles moved. But when they made contact with the people outside of the party, you know, they were compliant. They indicated that they were going to go along with the rules. And at least for some time, you know, they did. So. You know, generally speaking, with parties as a whole, we don't automatically shut them down. And even under the COVID restrictions, especially given that in this case, this was a private event. It wasn't, you know, a public occurrence, like at a public venue.
You mentioned the word rules, though, and I wonder what the rules are, because I think there's a lot of ambiguity about that. We reached out to the Department of Public Health. They issued a statement. And I'm going to read you a little of that statement. It says, the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health has issued a legally binding health officer order that prohibits gatherings, including parties, during this pandemic in order to protect the health and lives of county residents. So is that an order that your officers can or should enforce?
And you know, that's the interesting thing is that sometimes, you know, we'll get state orders and county orders. And quite frankly, I mean, some of this has come out as more as guidelines than orders. But understand, I mean, sometimes I mean, the words mean a lot, right, as far as, you know, what they are. But we specifically are going by the City of Los Angeles public order under City of Los Angeles Emergency Authority, where the subject is Safer LA. And you know, within there, I mean, there's actually a specific portion, but they say that this provision does not apply to gatherings within a single household or living unit, which like in this case, that was. And so, you know, Mayor Garcetti, I mean, and the city leaders, there was a tremendous amount of thought that was put into this that's based off of the county guidelines. But they had that specific Safer at LA, you know, those guidelines. And that's what has been distributed to our officers. That's what we adhere to. But I think more importantly, the enforcement aspect, it's not the intent for the police department to go out and make mass arrests or to force compliance. You know, we're in a time and an age right now where we're really trying to build greater public trust and coming off heavy-handed or you know overly difficult. It's not a good strategy right now. So what you know we're encouraged to do is to seek out compliance, to try to educate, to try to help people to understand how important it is. We want to save lives. And in order to do that, we need to have people wear their masks.
I just wonder, I mean, you know, what people are going to do is they're going to take it to the very last step, like to the limits of where the teeth come in, right? And that's where it's like, all right, so what can you do? If you've got hundreds of people in a house and you can't do anything about that, then what's the point in having rules?
I mean, I think that when the city, you know, order came out, and I mean, and they specifically exempt. I mean, I'm reading page three, you know, paragraph three, and it literally reads all public and private gatherings of any number of people occurring outside of a residence are prohibited, except those exempted activities described in this paragraph and paragraph five. But then it says this provision does not apply to gatherings within a single household or living unit. In my assessment or understanding of this document, I don't think that the government leaders want to infringe so greatly on like every single right. And that's honestly, it's just a balancing act because I mean, we have to think about public safety and people not, getting sick or contracting COVID. But on the same note, I mean, we have to be realistic that human beings are social, you know, there's a need for that. I mean, I think about how, I mean, the rate of suicides has increased exponentially. And I mean, you look at all of the other impacts that COVID has had. I mean, it's already a tough thing. The last thing that we want to do is to have like intrusive enforcement. You know, the Constitution, I mean, lines out like Fourth Amendment search and seizure rights. And, you know, there are exigent circumstances where we can go in and break up a party. But I mean, you could have, whether it's 10 people or 100 people, we, absent some exigent circumstances, we cannot go in to that private domicile and overstep our legal bounds. So, you know, that's the challenge is, you know, we're always working within, you know, making every effort to work within, you know, the parameters of the law and all of those guidelines. So that definitely makes it challenging.
I want to talk about another gathering that happened last Friday night. There was a party, apparently a private party at this place in Hollywood called the Sassafras Saloon. It was described as a party for first responders. LAPD is reportedly looking into whether any of your officers were at that party. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to speak to that because if the department is looking into whether or not there's any misconduct, that would actually turn into a personnel investigation or personnel matter. And those things through a variety of different, charters, codes, it's protected information that unfortunately I can't speak to.
All right. Well, what we have is, or CNN is reporting this, that the man inside identified one man they spoke with outside the venue, I should say, as an officer from the Southwest Division. And the man telling CNN, quote, "Everybody is either family or works at the same place, so that's why we don't have COVID concerns. Everyone's been tested and everything. That's why we all know that everyone in there is cool." Is that the perspective, though, of the LAPD? I mean, if people work in the same place, they can party together without masks or social distancing?
I can't speak to the incident or any comments that were reported to have been made by any individual, but again, because of the personnel matter issues, but I will tell you that in terms of the LAPD's stance on wearing masks, I know Chief Moore, as well as our command staff in general, have put out numerous notices. I know the most recent one from like July 27th of 2020, where we talk about the department expectations on wearing face coverings. And if people are in the city of LA, or if they're in they're in common areas, workplaces, and things of that nature, they are strongly encouraged, and they've been given masks. They're told that they need to wear masks. So that really covers on-duty conduct. It doesn't get into off-duty conduct. But there isn't an expectation, or there's not a us condoning folks going out and partying or any of the other things that you mentioned. But we cannot control all the actions of public gatherings, depending on where they're at. So that's pretty much where we're at with that.
So if the reporting is accurate, though, in your investigation, finds that there were officers, LAPD officers at that party or any party, do they face possible repercussions? I mean, what would those repercussions be?
You know, that would depend on the outcome of the investigation. And because, like I mentioned before, if there is an investigation, it's not something I can speak to.
I know we had, in the middle of the pandemic, and we still have protests, by the way, happening. George Floyd protests, where we saw most of the protesters wearing masks, many LAPD officers not wearing masks. Has it been tough to get officers to accept wearing a mask when in public? I mean, I've seen it myself, where it's like I'm walking outside with a mask on and I'll see police officers around without masks.
Well, I think when you look at police officers as a whole and then, just the population as a whole, I mean, getting people to wear masks has been an educational process. I mean, it's a matter of making people understand the importance of wearing them, making them understand that it could potentially save lives. But so I think that that has been a challenge with society as a whole. I think also for first responders, not only police officers, but I mean, anybody who, for example, has to communicate through a radio, or sometimes you have to give commands, or there's different things that are going on, and through the muffled masks, it's difficult. And so, sometimes there might be reasons that officers, maybe that's something that they're thinking about when they're not wearing them. But the long and short of it is we have continually, as a department, messaged to our officers that we need to see greater compliance, and we are seeing measures in that. We still, like anybody, have room to improve, but the messaging is that we need to see our officers wearing their masks, again, just to save lives. And you know, we are burying one of our own today. We lost Officer Val Martinez to COVID, and that's tragic. And so this is something that's very real and very close for many of us. And so I think that more folks are beginning, as this goes along, to take it seriously and start to wear more masks.
I mean, in the end, as we wrap things up, I mean, what do you think is the role of the LAPD when it comes to the pandemic? I've got a birthday coming up. I'd like to have, maybe 10, 20 people at the beach, in Venice. Am I going to get busted for that?
You know, the thing is that, again, kind of going through the way that things are right now, we don't want law enforcement to be the, primary enforcers of social gatherings and things of that nature. We want to educate every chance that we get, and when I say educate, ask people to practice proper social distancing. Wearing the masks is one part of it, but whether people are having social gatherings, just as much as they can adhere to the guidelines, as confusing sometimes as they may be, because there's differences between just, for example, even county and city guidelines. But we just ask for folks to practice safe social distancing, wear their masks, and in terms of our part in that, we don't see ourselves going out and making arrests or large enforcement in that regard. Really, our goal is to encourage, to educate, and try to appeal to people's sense of empathy and really have them understand that wearing masks can save lives.
Captain Stacy Spell, who commands the Media Relations Department over at the Los Angeles Police Department. Captain, thanks for your time.
Thank you, sir.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For many years, you may have chuckled at all the visitors who wanted to see Hollywood, the neighborhood. Outsiders thought of Hollywood as a place of glitz and glamour, but locals know it as a seedier area with its fair share of dive bars and tacky lingerie stores and, even some drug dealing. But when a big new mall opened at Hollywood and Highland in 2001, complete with white elephants on columns, a view of the Hollywood sign, and a new theater for the Oscars, there were high hopes that it would improve the area. Well, the quota of dive bars and drug dealing is definitely down, but the mall itself, that hasn't done so well. And now a new group of owners, the third in less than 20 years, are planning a big makeover. Frances Anderton covers design and architecture for KCRW. She's here to tell us more about it. Hey, Frances.
Hi, Steve.
Hollywood and Highland. I remember the first time I brought my parents to California. Many, many years ago, I took them to Hollywood and Highland because it was a big touristy area. They had to go see Hollywood, right? But it's kind of gotten in trouble.
Well, it's been a bit of a white elephant, you know, to just quote you. People in the mall industry were surprised last year when two investors named DJM Capital and Gore Capital bought Hollywood and Highland. This was a mall that had been sort of beset with problems from the start. And this was a big transaction. Real estate, to use real estate speak, people refer to this as the largest single asset retail transaction taking place outside of Manhattan in nearly 3 years. And this was because, as we all know, retail has been in steep decline. And this was a mall that had its own set of issues. It opened in 2001. That was just before 9/11. It hit this mall very badly. The first developers, Trizac Khan, then sold it in 2004 at a loss to the development company CIM, which then sold it again last year.
So tell us about the new buyers, the people who just purchased this property.
Well, they sound kind of interesting. As I said, one is called DJM Capital. They're headquartered in San Jose, and they specialize in taking over so-called underperforming retail centers and figuring out the right mix of stores and programming and food and public art to revive them. And then Gore Capital, well, this is helmed by a man named Goodwin Gore. He's based in Hong Kong, but he's invested quite heavily in historic properties in LA, among them the Roosevelt Hotel in Hollywood, where he gave that a turnaround, and the Bradbury Building in downtown. Now, Sten Parton is the chief retail officer at DJM, and he says the companies refer to themselves as, quote, contrarian investors, seeing an opportunity at Hollywood and Highland where others don't. Dan Lee is managing director with Gore Capital in the US, the US affiliate, and this is how he put it.
You know, we love this idea of finding challenging properties where through design, through activation, and through kind of a little bit of soul creating, we can really turn it around.
So soul creating is the issue here. Now, Sten Parton, he pointed out that this is a really important intersection. He says 25 million visitors pass through it. It's the home of the Oscars. It's on a big metro stop. Big media companies like Netflix and Viacom are based there. So he sees it as having lots of potential. Their challenge is to get some of those 25 million into Hollywood and Highland.
So what do they plan to do? I mean, notwithstanding the fact that I took my parents to Hollywood and Highland many years ago, it is a pretty confusing place, right?
Did you and your parents enjoy their visit?
I know we got I remember getting a chocolate chip cookie ice cream sandwich. And it was nice. My dad and I shared one in the middle of the courtyard. Again, that was so many years ago, though.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the courtyard, because we'll get to that in a minute. That's an important part of this project. I mean, generally, it's a kind of hulking project. It's confusing to get around. Yes, it has the Oscars theater, but you get to that through a kind of strange, dark passageway. And then in that courtyard, you have this very strange imagery, these elephants on columns, white elephants on columns, an archway taken from the set of Intolerance. That was this 1916 epic that took on themes, including the fall of the Babylonian Empire. It was directed by D.W. Griffith. Now, he's the now discredited filmmaker. He made the infamously racist film Birth of a Nation. So anyway, with that strange sort of set of challenges, the new owners, they're working with the design firm Gensler. And one of the interesting things that they plan to do is take the retail away from the top two floors of the mall. This is because apparently shoppers in the US don't like what's called vertical retail. They're going to put offices in place of that retail. They also plan to sort of clean up the whole place, clean up the signage, clean up the exterior billboards, make it look cleaner and make it more of a backdrop for a kind of experience. So David Glover's with Gensler. He said They want this place not to be just about consumption.
It's becoming a new hybrid. It's not simply a kind of place for consumerism. It will be a place to work. It will be a place that you can bring your family and kind of have a better, more rich experience.
And they want to get away from the theme designing that one associates with the mall now. They want more emphasis even on landscape.
And so we started to think that this is not necessarily an architectural project as much as it is a landscape project. What you'll see in the end is you'll see the grand stair that takes you from Hollywood Boulevard up to that main public realm as being this sort of garden space.
And just in case you're wondering, Steve, they do plan to get rid of the white elephants and the D.W. Griffith imagery. They feel that's not appropriate in this time.
So when is all this going to happen, Francis? Obviously, there are a lot of things in the works, a lot of plans. What kind of a timetable do we have?
Well, they plan to break ground later this year and then spend up to a year on a phased makeover of the project. They plan to spend $100 million. And they're very optimistic. They're hoping that by the time they fully reopen, we'll be past COVID, but that both offices and retail will be attractive again. And, you know, that for Hollywood and Highland, this is going to be third time lucky.
KCRW's Francis Anderton over at our design and architecture desk. Francis, as always, nice to have you on.
Likewise.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for being with us. Most museums across the county are currently closed. Galleries, too. And yes, many have moved to virtual viewing, or some galleries are doing showings by appointment only. Art goes on. But has our relationship to it changed? I mean, come on. A big aspect of art is experiencing art, seeing it, getting close to it. And if there are fewer folks going to museums and galleries and seeing the art in person, is the art itself changed? Lindsay Preston-Zappas is our art insider and editor-in-chief of the Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. She's here to answer those questions. Hi, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
This is almost like that question, you know, if a tree falls in the woods and no one's there to hear it, does it make a noise? If art is happening at galleries that are not open and you're unable to see it, is there still art?
Yeah, and that's what we're seeing across the city. We're seeing a lot of exhibitions that are up but closed. It's very bizarre. It's a weird time.
So since the pandemic started, how many actual museums or galleries have you physically been to? Have you been able to do that?
Sparingly, maybe 10. And I asked a couple other art critics and they also had similar experiences. You know, they've been to galleries that are outdoors or, you know, outdoor experiences. So I don't think I'm alone in that experience.
So you're saying 10 in the course of 5 months before the pandemic? What was it like? How many galleries or museums did you make it to?
Oh, man. Yeah. Before the pandemic, I was going to at least 5 shows a week, like usually 1 day a week, hopping around to 5 galleries, plus openings on the weekends. So it's been a big shift. It's interesting, though. I'm currently editing an upcoming issue of my magazine, Carla, and about half of the reviews that we're covering are virtual, which is really telling that sort of gives you a lens on what our writers have been able to access and physically see in person.
I know LACMA, the LA County Museum of Art, is all virtual right now. Are there any museums or galleries that are open that you can physically go to?
So yeah, museums are under kind of different logistics and rules on a citywide level than galleries are in terms of closures. So the museums are closed at the moment, and most of them have shifted to virtual programming, right? So we're seeing a lot of these museums, LACMA has a virtual page on their website where they're posting videos and interviews with artists and, you know, browsing their collection online and things like that. MoCA has a similar program called Virtual MoCA, where there are lectures and things like that. And, you know, I think a lot of museums have programming lined up this fall, so it really remains to be seen how this will all happen. I mean, I think as much as people are planning ahead, they're also just waiting on logistical kind of clearances from the city of reopening.
I wonder, Lindsay, if there's a way to make an appointment or to not just have an open door where people can walk in from the street and go see art, buy a ticket and go inside, or you know, just see what's inside that gallery, where you would go online, or you would set up an appointment to go see it yourself to get fewer people inside those physical places. Is that something that we're seeing a lot of now?
That's exactly what we're seeing. Yeah. So galleries are shifting to this appointment only model, where a person, a viewer, would go online, email the gallery, or some of them have even little forms on the website that kind of make an appointment for you. And you go in and you have this timed experience where you might be the only one there. There might be one other viewer there. And, you know, hand sanitizer, face mask, that's all part of this timed experience.
And fewer people inside the physical building, so you feel a little more comfortable, right, about being in there.
Definitely. The handful of galleries that I have gone to in person, to be honest, it felt really safe in terms of a pandemic experience. You know, you can really control the distance. It's very different than being in like a public park or somewhere where a lot of people are around, because really it's you and the art. And the art, I think, isn't contagious at the moment. We don't think so. So,
but it sounds to me, Lindsay, like if we're doing appointment only, that it makes the accessibility of art, you know, sort of take a turn going backward. Instead of getting art to everyone, now you got to call and make an appointment. And it seems more exclusive. It seems farther away.
Sure. I think that's a really valid concern, right? Because I think a lot of the conversations we have around museums is like, how do we get art more out there for the general public? How do we create an open door that's welcoming the general public? But I've talked to a lot of gallerists, and they actually are really loving the appointments. I've heard from several people that they're not seeing a huge difference in numbers in terms of attendance. And the thing about the appointment, too, is that a visitor makes a timed appointment, and they're going to show up. Like, if you make an appointment somewhere, you're not going to just be like, I don't feel like it. Like, you're going to go and show up, and the gallery knows you're coming. So in that time that they're expecting you, I had one gallerist tell me that, you know, the visitors are getting a lot more kind of personal attention than they might have gotten otherwise, because they know that you're coming and they can really walk you through and kind of give you more access into the exhibition. So, I mean, for those who are brave enough to kind of go through that barrier of making the appointment, I do think once you're there, you are given a bit more access into an art exhibition, actually. But, you know, I think what's interesting, too, is alongside all that, we're seeing all these virtual exhibitions, which provide another set of access to people that might not normally go to an exhibition. So you can get a 3D tour of an art show online from your living room. So that's kind of an interesting moment that I do think the virtual space has an opportunity to sort of extend past a traditional audience that might, you know, get in their car, look at a map, figure out where a gallery is, decide to go to one. You know, there's a lot of barriers in Los Angeles that we have to go to a gallery in the first place, I think. But, you know, I personally am really anxious to just be back to seeing things in person on a regular basis. It's so important. A JPEG is not art. Like, we need to see things in person. So we're all kind of looking to get back to that.
And in the meantime, adaptation is sort of the name of the game in the art business, I'm sure. Lindsay Preston-Zappas, our art insider and the editor-in-chief over Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Lindsay, as always, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, what about you? We'd like to hear your thoughts. Do you think law enforcement should be doing more to fight the pandemic? Like breaking up big parties in private homes or ticketing folks without masks? Have you seen officers themselves not complying? KCRW.com/AskGreaterLA. Tomorrow, a fight in the dirt in Boyle Heights, an update on the coronavirus in California, and Black Restaurant Week starts this weekend. The places you can go and businesses you can support. That's tomorrow. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Amy Tom, Mike Newport, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Jody Adler, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on this show today. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ears and time this evening. Have a great night.